had fundamental changes in the structure of society, and particularly at the replacement of the authoritarian state by some form of non-governmental cooperation between free individuals.
You're listening to a collaborative radio project between Miami Autonomy and Solidarity and Recomposition Blog. Today we speak with Phineas from Canada about struggles of Canadian postal workers, his experiences as a radical, and the upsurges that happened recently.
Creates this alienation. The capitalist mode of production creates this alienation.
This is Scott Napolo speaking to Phineas, a Canadian postal worker and radical at Left Forum. And we're talking about the struggles that happened in the Canadian Postal Service and CUPW Union around the new collective agreement and attempts to rationalize and mechanize postal work. So Phineas, can you tell us just a little bit about what happened and what the struggle was about?
Well, there was a series of direct actions by workers on the floor, mostly around several issues, but basically it was related to some big technological changes that are happening in the way Canada Post delivers the mail. At the same time, there was a collective agreement in place and some major equipment changes. So that's kind of the start of what happened was that for a backdrop.
So what's actually at stake in those struggles when you're saying, you know, some equipment changes? If those changes had gone through, what would have been the problem with them?
Well, the first city that implemented the equipment changes saw an injury rate increase by 1,200%. They also were projecting work cuts of about 20% of the workforce. So tens of thousands of workers would be made redundant. We have collective agreement language in place that prevents layoffs, but we would have been facing basically a whole bunch of workers finding intensification of their work as they pick up the slack for the workers that were leaving because of redundancy. Or the workers that were leaving through attrition, rather, sorry.
Got it. And so I know normally with these struggles, you have union agreements come up for expiration, there's negotiations, and mechanization typically goes through. And historically, with postal work in the U.S., we already have many of these changes and then some that you all have. So what happened that was different in your situation around the struggle?
Well, I think that one of the big turning points was when the workers basically refused to stop picking up the slack for the corporation, and they refused to take forced overtime. And that was the point where the corporation was having big problems getting the work done. There was a lot of threats of discipline, but the workers kind of stood strong. And, you know, and we probably had a total of about 1,600 people participating in actions around forced overtime over a four-month period. And that led to Canada Post having to hire about 200 new workers in a period where they were planning on actually making cuts.
And by the corporation, you mean the Canadian Postal Service. Just to clarify for the U.S., because we don't call it a corporation here. But
yeah, the Canada Post Corporation, it's a crown corporation. So basically it's a corporation that's owned 100% by the government. But yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay, so in an environment where they were attempting to mechanize and cut, you all were able to win actually more staff, at least for a period. Now, as an organizer and a radical working within those struggles, how was it that you were able to organize those direct actions?
Yeah, there's definitely a few things. One was our direct action course that was modeled on the IWW organizer training, and we had a bunch of direct action role plays that we put members through. We put about 80 militants through that course before these job actions happened. And what we did was we put the skills directly in the members' hands so they could act on their own initiative and under their own direction. And so that I think was one of the major factors. The other one was building a communications infrastructure through text message lists that allowed people to text each other horizontally, which meant that there were no bottlenecks. And sometimes the information would come out quick and sloppy, like there was minor inaccuracies in some of the information, but overall members could communicate very quickly over a very broad base, and that allowed the members to kind of take the struggle into their own hands, so it wasn't really being directed by any central point. And that made it very hard for like the typical kind of mediating role of a lot of labor organizations to take on. It made it very difficult also to single anybody out, and it also made it very, very difficult to bottleneck or control the messaging or channel it into less, basically less confrontational forms.
So there was kind of a structure in place and a method of organizing that opened up some space for people to move forward. I know you all did a lot of work around kind of education and developing members into organizers and leaders, so that you're kind of describing how that came forward, but there was also like a whole layer of people that when that space opened up, right, stepped into force, started organizing their own actions. How would you describe developing that leadership, making it so members were actually not just like participating, but leading the struggles themselves?
Yeah, some of it was mentorship and just like, and kind of directly more experienced militants talking to newer, younger militants and helping them through the process by sharing stories and telling them what happened, giving advice. Some of it was also creating a kind of a forum where ideas and organizing could be discussed, like in various organizing committees that were based in the depots. And that created a forum where people could report on what they happened and also debrief and kind of critique their own organizing and develop it in the direction that they wanted to see it go. So I think the main thing was like there was a lot of like, I guess typically you call it leadership development, but usually when you're doing, when other organizers talk about leadership development, they're talking about only developing leaders. And this was very much like based at anybody who would listen. And we really tried to make sure that as much as possible, we could put it in everybody's hands. And with that sort of development and that experience came a lot of confidence. And with that confidence came a willingness to take action without asking permission, without talking to people first. And it might add that like this, like almost all of this happened outside of the union infrastructure. Like a lot of us were union members. The vast majority were union members. There were lots of stewards, even some executive members that were involved, but basically it was outside of the typical traditional union infrastructure, even though we were all pretty supportive of the union.
Additionally, I know that there were a few key leaders amongst women and people of color, and by and large, for those who don't know, there's a lot of women workers and people of color in the Canadian Post Office, and you were saying you handed it out to anybody who would hear it, but there was also kind of strategic attempts to politically build leadership and struggle and all that. Can you say anything about how that worked, why it worked in your case, what y'all did?
Yeah, definitely. Well, part of it was that I mean, some people would kind of come out of the ranks naturally, and obviously a lot of the women and people of color had concerns. The truth is that one of our best organizing tools was racism and sexism from management, and that created a dynamic that was very useful and good for us to work with and to develop it. And I think that was kind of a lot of the driving impetus, and there definitely was a political commitment on our part to develop militants and people that are more marginalized parts of the working class. But it doesn't hurt either that when management is just so heinously bigoted.
So what was the outcome of these struggles? You had a series of direct actions leading to some victories, a collective bargaining agreement in the standard way. Where's the kind of struggle headed now, and where did the chips fall when everything came out of the air?
It's really hard to say because the chips haven't entirely fallen yet. The collective bargaining agreement is now going to an arbitrator, and we're kind of under the gun with some pretty serious back-to-work legislation. And so that created a dynamic where there were pretty severe penalties for us taking some of the action that would disrupt production. And so that we're kind of waiting for that to come out in the wash. However, like in Edmonton, we managed to force the corporation to hire hundreds of workers. We managed to develop a pretty strong base on the floor. We won a lot of little fights too, like one department won parking. That was a major issue that management said they would never cave on. Another department won new management because the old ones were like ones that were pretty upset about. People won extra breaks in one installation that was very hot. So there was lots of little things. And sometimes that's actually what builds the most militancy. And it kind of comes back to the question about women and people of color, is that sometimes the most radical fights that you can pick on and the stuff that develops the floor the most are basic issues of dignity and respect. So the bread and butter gains can be really important. But sometimes what you've got is what's actually business unions call it in their kind of jargon is what's called non-monetary issues, something that doesn't actually cost the corporation anything, but they could give, but basically for whatever reason they don't.
And lastly, as somebody who's not just involved in these things because you want more money or to protect your pension or whatever, but a revolutionary trying to create a different world, what role do you see as struggle around your work and these struggles in the Canadian Postal Office And what kind of method can you point to for other radicals wanting to do similar work?
Well, I mean, there's a few things. I'm going to start with the political work because it's really important. It's really important that you have an analysis and material and something that you can give people beyond just militancy. And so you give people a reason for why we're fighting. And so we always drove home when we were arguing for things, and a lot of our fights were coordinated through mass coffee break meetings, which were basically assemblies, that this wasn't just because we thought it was nice to do this or it was a spectacle, but because we felt that that was a political commitment on our part, because this was part of the world we were trying to build. This was the democracy we believed in. And so tying our forms of struggle to our political analysis was really important for a lot of us. The other thing, too, is what really makes a difference is a certain amount of seriousness in organization and building infrastructure. And sometimes that sounds like a lot of work and can be really daunting, but it's better to build slow and deliberately and with a structure and a method than it is to kind of go off half-cocked running in every direction. And in the end, you'll actually save yourself a lot of work if you're deliberate about it and you take your time.
Well, thanks for speaking with us, and we hope that things work out in the post office and your movement keeps building.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to our program today. Be sure to check back for more content at miamiautonomyandsolidarity.wordpress.com, recomposition.info, more articles, interviews, audio recordings, and artwork.